Welcome to this final episode in the fourth series of Embracing Your Mortality with me, Sue Brain. Over the winter, I've been talking to some amazing people, including the creators of The Silent Why, a truly wonderful podcast full of hope.
We're just learning so much and a lot of humility as well for what people have been through and have come out stronger.
A couple turning John Lennon's Gypsy Caravan into a story space for children.
It did make you wonder whether, if not the spirit of John Lennon, the spirit of the wind whispering through somehow.
And a world-renowned crop circle researcher, lecturer and artist.
Every year the slate is wiped clean. Those crop circles are gone.
Ruth McCarthy is on a mission to help us all to develop good listening skills so we can transform our thinking, encourage engagement and transform our conversations from the dull to the dynamic.
I was invited into a startup, which was a really interesting idea. It was about mentoring young people, mentoring them through university when they weren't doing vocational degrees, which is actually something I think still really necessary. Brilliant idea, but very, very hard to get traction. Very, very hard to, because young people don't want to ask their parents for money. It was quite expensive. It was a private service. And it was looking to make a profit. But I learned so much, and that's where I first heard of Nancy Klein. That's where the link was. And so in January 2008, I did my first Thinking Partnership program with Nancy, having had the great good fortune to ring up the number I found on the website and actually speak to her. And even just the conversation with her was so sort of inspiring and thoughtful. Of course, she was just being what she is, which is somebody who helps people to think, you know, but it was just the most perfect small experience that kind of was a tipping point for me, I suppose. So I started the course. I met some really interesting people on that course. They remain my colleagues and friends to this day. I can remember sitting, must have been the second afternoon, sitting in this nice hotel kind of sitting room, which is what she used then, her asking me what I was assuming that was holding me back or some such from, I can't remember the exact object, but deciding what to do next or whatever. And it was the most extraordinary, revelatory few minutes. I mean, it was like a light went on in my head, you know, and you get that rush of energy for when something that's been in your way gets out of your way and you can suddenly see something afresh. And of course, that's what we do with our assumptions. You know, we block ourselves. I mean, unwittingly, of course. Mm. And I came away with such a sense of purpose and not quite knowing still where to put it, but just knowing that what I needed to do, wanted to do most in the world was do what she'd done for me, which was to help me to think for myself. So if I was to give you a one-phrase definition of what I do, it is that I spend as much time as I can every day helping people to discover the extraordinary liberation of thinking for them, as and for themselves. And that a side effect to that is that I help people to listen.
Tell me about your experience of our non-listening society.
Oh, yes, goodness. Well, where along the spectrum should we go? At the sort of soft end, you could say, you have very interruptive conversations, which mean that people aren't heard, which mean that they're not understood, which even in family, or particularly in family relationships, is very damaging. You have interruption, direction, correction, advice, listening to reply. And listening to reply, I think, blocks the brain, or rather I should say the mind. It blocks the mind from understanding the content because we're so busy creating the reply or just looking for the gaps. At the other end, I'm afraid you have the horror of polarization, binary thinking. I think it bedevils our world now because vested interests have taken up the incredible power of social media to interrupt people's thinking, interrupt it through extremely carefully devised and placed messaging, which is incredibly influential and really dangerous. I mean, this is Brave New World. This is 1984. This is all of that. We're in it now. It's happened. We're all susceptible, but those who put themselves in the way of it develop binary beliefs. That's what I think. So Brexit is a good example. It's so black or white. And when people polarize like that, they are absolutely unable to hear. They cannot listen to the other side. I'm not saying time to think is the way out of that, but I think that the only answer is individually, one-to-one, to have people sit with each other and actually agree to listen for just 3 minutes to what the other person has to say. Just for 3 minutes. And then another three, and then another three.
How do we do this in a world that is so overloaded with information? And how do we hold ourselves back and hold ourselves in our place to be open enough to actually be present for 3 minutes?
That's my question too. I don't claim to have the answers, but I think this way of being with people is the how, is how to then persuade people to try it out and how to get people into a frame, a mindset that isn't so fear-driven as is the consequence of what we're just talking about, this social messaging, the social media, Facebook, you know, whatever it is they're looking at. And the iniquity of governments that buy into that, because of course that's what we've got. I mean, this is a huge political question as well. I think it makes people terribly fearful, and it's really hard to get people to think well when they're fearful, when we are fearful. So I don't know the answer to that question, other than it's two people in a room listening to each other.
Because the word is receptive, isn't it? You can sit like this, can't you?
Yes. Yes.
You know, not receptive, and you go, right, okay, my turn. You know, you can do that number, or you can actually open your heart to each other and just go, okay, I'm here for you. What, you know, what do you want to say to me? So how do you work with that?
Well, I don't have to. I mean, that's not my job. You know, I'm absolutely not a mediator, and I don't set out to find, you know, irreconcilable situations. I mean, there's quite enough of disagreement out there in the normal world without looking for the really difficult stuff. When I work in a consultancy and, you know, do that regularly, that's my most regular gig, as it were. And I mean, the results have been very, very powerful. And occasionally, two people are in standoff. I come in and I sit down with this. And this maybe is partly the answer to your question, actually. I book a 3-hour session. So the first one comes and I say to you, what are your thoughts about this? And in the context of this, you know, what do you want to say? And off they go. I mean, really, it's a kind of, you can imagine. But after the first sort of 15, 20 minutes, it always becomes calmer and it always becomes more, these are obviously intelligent, well-meaning people in that fundamentally, but they've got themselves into a sticky place with their dislike for each other. That's a download. And then that person goes away and the other person arrives. And then I get the second download. And I'm not making any call on this or any judgment. I'm being the generator of their thinking in classic time to think fashion. I'm not replying to it. And if they say, what do you think? I say, it doesn't really matter what I think. What more do you think? So it keeps them, you know, in the place. Then the other will come back and order a pot of tea and make it as, you know, in some nice place. It's very important there's a nice place. I will say, we've agreed who might go first. I get the timer out. I say, okay, in these 3 minutes, what do you need so-and-so to know? And that's how it starts. And what do you need so-and-so to know? And then back, and then back, and then back. And after 3 or 4 exchanges, so that might be they've had, it could be up to 20 minutes each before they really start to listen, but they do. Mm. They do. What I think the magical thing is they start to see each other as humans with similar feelings. And even though they've gone off in completely different directions, they've, you know, they start to see the human in each other, the whole kind of namaste thing. Mm. And that is when it breaks through.
So you would be invited in to organization because they're having listening problems or they're having thinking problems or the team isn't working well for some reason.
Mm. Mm. We have sort of beautiful process for working with groups, you know, simple as getting people into pairs, which funnily enough online is turning out to be hugely productive because it's truly private. Other people cannot see or hear in the way you might do around the table or even in a big room. I mean, it takes a lot of preparation too, and it's not about remedial. It's about building on what's there already. It's about people being honest, I suppose. The team leader, manager, whoever it is, will tell me what he or she thinks is the problem. The others, the people involved, may see it quite differently.
Really?
Imagine that. Very often people come to me through the website, through the Time to Think website, because they have read Nancy's book and something in it strikes such a chord. I've had people literally ring up and say, can you come next week? I just realized this is exactly what we need, because we are all arguing with each other around the table. The thing is, they need to get to know each other better, get more respect for each other's thinking, and understand just how much they're blocking in terms of progress if they don't stop. And because they're all super bright, they realized. And after the first couple of rounds around the table, you know, after the first couple of pairs where I paired the tricky with the tricky, the atmosphere just changes so much. And you can imagine that deep listening that goes on. And, you know, the other day, you know, several people fed back just how extraordinary they found it, how peaceful and different they felt afterwards. And that's what the result of not being interrupted all the time.
We've always been taught to be competitive.
Yes.
And I wonder if this is what is driving this inability to listen, is I have a better idea than you.
Yes. Yes, it is. One of the principles of this is encouragement, but not as in rah, rah, well done, although let's face it, that's better than nothing. It's much harder. It's about recognizing that we have a drive to compete. It's an internal drive. It's evolutionary. And it will get in the way of every single conversation unless we acknowledge it and sit with it and say, whoops, shut up. I need to listen to this. The listening is improved enormously if we can achieve that, even some of the time, and particularly in a group. And to make it happen, we have a protocol in a group where we say, okay, we've got 20 minutes. Here's our question that we're seeking to answer. We are six people, so that would be 3 minutes each, makes 18 minutes. If somebody takes 10, you are actually smashing it for the other people. So this own the time, here's the clock in the middle of the table or up on the wall, whatever it is, 3 minutes. And I actually now just use a timer. And when 3 minutes is up, it's like, thank you, that's great, on to the next. This is equality, another huge principle in this. For the period of time we're working together, we are equal as thinkers, regardless of anything else. That's huge, because I come with a brain and you come with a brain. Mm-hmm. Who's to say your brain's better than mine? Mm-hmm. That's not possible. It's a different brain. And if that brain isn't needed at the table, then let it go away. Let that person leave, rather than sit there being treated as no use. It's tough. You know, it's really tough.
Tough love.
Yes, it is tough love.
Yes.
It's very loving.
Yes.
I don't know if you've ever encountered the work of Umberto Maturana, the Chilean biologist, wonderful man.
Yeah.
His concept of love being the only emotion that expands our intelligence. I mean, that is exactly what's needed in the world now. If everybody knew, and by love, we don't mean physical or sentimental or passionate or sexual or any of that. We mean love that regards the person in front of you as legitimate. Mm. That's what it is.
Do you feel that there is a difference in the generations that you work with? I don't know how old you are, but I'm in my 60s, well into my 60s now. Do you think that we have a different ability to think than the younger generation do? Or do you see it's just absolutely across the board that we've all forgotten how to communicate, actually, because that's what we're dealing with?
Yeah, that's a big question. I wouldn't like to say it's a generational thing, because I have some extraordinary experiences with young people. I'd like to hope that rather than it being a kind of development, it's just a response, and that one can quite quickly, by being this kind of listener that listens to ignite new thinking rather than listens to come in and compete, that by being that with anyone of any generation, people discover quite quickly, with great joy, their capacity to be a thinker and even a listener. And then, of course, that's a build. Once people start to do that, can be powerfully transformational. I look at myself, I think, how good am I at this? And I know it's probably a different category to people who haven't done all this work with Nancy Klein. Of course it would be. Any kind of expertise is like that. Mm. And I know I can let it drop. I can get just as upset. Once I'm ambushed by my own emotions, it can be very difficult to stay in a place of calm receptive listening. So I think one needs to have enormous humility with this and not ever think, oh, I'm some guru of listening or something. Nancy certainly doesn't. She gets very upset by that kind of implication. She says, what I'm good at is at noticing. You know, noticing as people are thinking, noticing what they're saying, and noticing what they need in order to keep thinking. Mm. And that's it. You know, we just all need this level of listening. Yeah. And then we'll be great thinkers.
I think it's this sense of never being heard. And I'm wondering what's coming for me is a lack of boundaries in our world. You know, a lot of parenting now is not about saying no, it's about all saying yes. I feel heard when somebody hears something that's going on inside me that I'm uncomfortable about. If you have a no boundary, nobody says no to you, how do you even begin to know who you are inside yourself?
Yes. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think good parents listen to their children. Wise parents make sure they listen to their children and then respond according to the age of the child with firmness, with whatever it is needed. I mean, that would be the model for me. You don't just, you know, my mother-in-law, for example, is a great one. She's 93. You know, she just thinks you say no. She just says, does he understand no yet? And I think, well, he's 5. So no, he doesn't actually yet, because he hasn't got the brain boundaries. Yes. But they have to be explained. They have to, and his parents, my daughter and her, and my son-in-law, are very emotionally intelligent. And so they've, you know, read Daniel Goldman's book and all the books they can find that help them see what he really needs. And it's working. I mean, he's remarkably able to explain how he's feeling. And that is so helpful. Amazing. So, you know, on the day that he was to go back to school after the long break, and they'd had homeschooling and they were exhausted, and he did want to go back, but he's a little bit introverted, so you know, it was quite a big step for him. He was actually able to say, I feel a bit sick, mummy, but it's because I'm sad in my tummy. Isn't that so much better than him having a sort of hysterical tantrum at the door?
Absolutely.
You know, it's just amazing.
Oh my god.
Yes.
And he's 5.
He's 5. He's 5. He was 5 this week, actually. So he was 4 when this happened. And I was so impressed. And I thought,
parents,
you know, that is where it will happen, when parents can help a child to understand their bodies, their feelings, their whole self. Just to your point, actually. But of course, they're the exception, because, you know, they are able to do it because they've done the work. I think most parents could do it, but they need to be shown how. And if they're not in touch with their own feelings, then they have to do a lot of work in order to be able to make it safe for the child to be in touch with their own feelings. None of it's prioritised very much, although schools have got much, I think there's a lot of very intelligent school teachers out there and head teachers full of intention to make this work. You know, there's somebody on a course with me at the moment who's an FE expert, you know, further education, and hearing her speak is amazing. So that's where I find some hope too.
Yeah. I find that incredibly hopeful, personally, you know, because I was brought up with parents and never what they thought was how I should think. Yes. So it took me years and years and years to work out what I thought and be okay with what I thought.
Yes.
And being different to other people. You know, if you were to give an advice to anybody about breaking that down, what would you say to them?
Well, that's tough, isn't it? Because it shuts things down. Because any challenge to that implicitly says your thinking isn't right, so you're not right, so you're a bad person, so you're in shame, so. That's where people go. I mean, that's a very simplistic formula, but I do think that's kind of what happens. We had a very interesting experiment. Mind you, again, it's with people with a sort of heightened level of awareness of this, I suppose. But in looking at this whole idea of polarization, we had an experiment in one of our collegiate meetings where pre-arranged two people were prepared to speak, one for Brexit and one against, and two people, one for abortion and one against. It began with a brilliant question. In the context of abortion or Brexit, what matters to you most? That person got 3 minutes to speak to that. And then the same question was asked in the, you know, to, of the other person. And Nancy was mediating this and essentially led the thinking, I think, three times through that cycle. And there were a lot of people there, about 50 people there, and everyone was rapt because these two people were speaking so honestly to what they really thought. And then at the end, she simply asked for their freshest thinking, and they got a moment, a few minutes to speak to that. And both of them said, if I could paraphrase, something like, I haven't changed my mind, but now I understand so much better why you think the way you do. And you could feel the warmth between them that wasn't there at the beginning. At the beginning, it was quite prickly. But that was such a powerful object lesson to me. And it does presuppose a willingness. And then perhaps a mediator, but certainly this gentle, wonderful, powerful questioning, you know, what matters to you most?
And I love that, you know, and what's your freshest thinking now? That's beautiful. I've read a lot about, you know, how we create a schema, because that is our, that's our safety look at the world. We really invest in that schema because we think that's us. And I was doing some research into the effect of thinking on the amygdala, which is our fight, flight, freeze. And it really came to me that if somebody turns around to you and says, your schema is a load of crap, they are threatening your life.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And the amygdala doesn't know the difference.
No.
You know, between that and a physical assault. Yeah. So you're in deep trouble. And the amygdala can be is triggered in 0.7 of a second, so you don't have much option. It, that happens so fast, and people go into defense or attack or whatever, or appease. I only got that recently.
Wasn't that interesting?
Very, Sue, very.
Interesting. Because,
yeah, because I think that's where I go, somewhere between freeze if it's really bad, because you thought, but appease if I feel I can do that, you know, if I can make it better. I suppose helpful to other people, but terribly bad for me. It's so painful to try to appease and have that thrown back at you, as well as whatever went wrong in the first place.
Why do you feel we're so terrified of stepping out of our schema? For instance, if we believe Toby over there in the corner is wrong, how do we step out of that schema of him being wrong?
He's not wrong. He's just different. And he is legitimate. To notice and know that no two people think the same, therefore everybody thinks differently, and that any in any group, if reality isn't represented properly by difference, we don't have reality in the room. So that's why most boards and things are all white, privileged, educated people, for example. That's fine, but it's not. It's fine in that they can do some of the jobs, but it isn't representing the reality of that they serve. You know, as the board of a big company that sells widgets, they need the reality of the lives of others in the room in order to make best decisions, which is, you know, borne out by all the research that shows the improved performance just of boards that include now one or two women. And that isn't even diversity. How dare anyone say that 50, you know, women represent diversity? We don't. We're 52% of the population. We're actually the norm. And similarly, you know, for people of different orientations or people of, you know, if you look at their actual representation, I mean, 14% of the population in this country is BAME. And therefore, in every organization, there ought to be 14% at senior levels in order to properly present, you know, represent reality, just reality. So you can see how far we are from that. The reason we have so much trouble is because that difference isn't represented, and therefore it isn't heard, and therefore it isn't seen, and therefore it isn't understood. And for as long as we maintain that marginalized, compartmentalized attitude, we will struggle with this. And that's otherness as well, isn't it? So it taps into the very fundamental fear thing. So you have otherness and difference being, you know, pushed away. And you have homogeneity and groupthink and, you know, entitlement and privilege.
You know, we're sitting on, oh God, you know, 2,000 years of patriarchal conditioning. This is huge to break down. I mean, women want to step up, obviously, but I'm not sure that they want to step up into that kind of very male, I'm going to rule the world kind of battleground that the males love, because it's testosterone. You know, I'd hate to do that.
Yes.
I'd love to contribute to it, but I couldn't possibly survive in an environment like that. And I think a lot of women feel like that. They just go, no, it's not for me.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the hopeful things. I think there's a great deal of work and change going on in that space. But my fear is that COVID has done huge damage to it, because as soon as childcare disappeared, the women got hammered. I mean, so many women have lost pace, lost their place at work, been seen differently. And it's on the other hand, you could say, and there is good evidence for this, that it could turn out to be a kinder world eventually, or even sooner, because people have seen the realities behind their employees' lives and have had to show their own, and that has had some equalising effect. But I would agree with that, and I've had some experience of that with the organisations that I work with, where bosses have had to realise that these young people, whom they're calling upon to do extraordinary levels of work, live in small flats, don't have a room that they can be quiet in. And mothers, you know, the young mother on this team, she said, you know, Ruth, I really miss the commute, because that was like my buffer zone. An hour of reading a book or just being on my own and getting my head into the workspace. I mean, and these young mums, I mean, the burnout level, you know, over these months, because they're exhausted, because they don't even have that, as you say, they're not escaping. Yeah. So it's not just the young people, it's the young mothers. And I say young mothers advisedly, because research is showing that, of course, even though the men did more, they didn't do anything like as much as was needed to get the mother into a place of having enough time to be a professional, to be in her role.
I mean, this is really a massive experience of society listening to what's going on.
Yeah.
Coming straight back to the listening thing.
I couldn't agree more. It was the longest pause we're ever likely to have in society. I don't think I ever felt more, to your point, that if society needs to listen in order to improve, then we need great listeners. And to go right back to the beginning, when people say, what is it you do? I say, I teach people to listen. And I can only do as much as I can do and as well as I can. And I can't change the whole world, but I feel it ripples out. And that everyone who does a program or even a workshop goes away listening differently.
Thank you, Ruth. What great advice to us all. And you can find out more about Ruth through her website, thinkitthrough.co.uk. Well, Ruth's episode brings us to the end of this fourth series.
I could almost recite everything she said. It's a gift.
Losses make you the person that you are.
To sit in the middle of a wheat field and just listen to nature, you know, it is magical.
This, I think, is the key to enjoying life here, is actually treating it like a huge adventure.
Seems like there's somebody here that's not us.
When we can actually be in our power, be who we are freed up to live a life that we want.
It's like when you fall in love, there's no need to even say anything anymore.
To notice and know that no two people think the same, therefore everybody thinks differently.
We want people to come away and feel inspired and want to do something themselves with their precious life.
I am planning another series, my fifth series, for the autumn. But in the meantime, I wish you a wonderful summer. And as always, I hope you'll do whatever it takes to embrace your mortality so you too can live more consciously for a better world. If you want to find out more about me, please go to suebrain.co.uk. Bye for now.
The Embracing Your Mortality podcast was researched and recorded by Sue Brain and produced and edited by The Podcast Den.